A new code for clamping is going out to public consultation, which will hope to see clampers not engaging in predatory behaviour towards motorists. The draft document is published by the National Transport Authority in order to establish standards in relation to the general behaviour, performance of duties and conduct of clampers. It's expected that about 130 motorists are clamped every day in Dublin City, either for parking illegally or if their payment has expired. Clamping Regulation Manager at the National Transport Authority, Patricia Craven, is on the line. Patricia, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, why are you starting this initiative now? Have you had loads and loads and loads of complaints about the clampers?
We're starting the initiative because we're required under the legislation to establish this code. The legislation, as you know, came into effect initially in October in 2017, and we felt that it would be useful to let the legislation bed itself in and get some time to take learnings from what's actually happening on the ground before we prepared it, because we thought it would be an opportunity to provide clarity around areas that mightn't have been abundantly clear from the outset. In terms of complaints, I mean, and appeals, we received last year just under 2,000 second stage appeals. So as you're probably aware, the legislation allows for a two-stage appeal process that motorists can access when they have been clamped.
Yeah, explain that two-stage. What's stage one?
So stage one is that the motorist must appeal the clamp directly to the parking controller concerned. So they have a period of 60 days to do that, and the parking controller is required to respond with a decision within 21
okay,
days.
Okay, it's not the individual, it is the company that is running
the
clamping
exactly.
operation. Okay, so yes. That's where you go first. And then?
And then if it's not successful at that stage, then there's a second stage process, which is coming to the NTA. So the NTA has designated clamping appeals officers who will look at the second stage appeal. They'll receive the appeal form from the motorist, and they'll request the information from the parking controller, and they will make a determination as to whether the clamp was valid.
What kind of evidence do you have to produce? I suppose it depends on the nature of your complaint. I mean, if, for example, you're massively pregnant and you're parked on a double yellow line near Hollis Street and they clamp you. You say, well, here's the baby.
Well, I suppose fundamentally a double yellow line is it's a breach of the rules of the road. It's an absolute contravention. And, you know, I suppose that speaks to the point of discretion and goodwill, which we would really expect that would be largely given by the parking controller at the first stage appeal process. You know, when it comes to the second stage, by and large, the clamping appeals officers will kind of focus on the validity of the clamp in the first instance. In terms of evidence, the requirements under the legislation are quite stringent, really. A parking controller and a clamping operator really have to evidence the contravention or the offence that they say has given rise to the clamp. So, for example, in the event of a non-payment of a ticket, you know, they'd be taking pictures of the windscreen to determine that or to demonstrate that there is no ticket displayed on the car windscreen. They have to afford the grace period and show that the motorist has had the 10 minutes to go and purchase a ticket and return to it. If it's a case that the car has been clamped for a breach of the rules of the road, like parking opposite a continuous white line, they have to take proper clear photographic evidence of that. All of the photographic evidence has to be date and time stamped. So, you know, there is quite an abundance of evidence that is required, and that's quite a high standard required of the parking controllers and clamping operators. From the motorist perspective then, I mean, you know, they can send in, I suppose, depending on what their grounds of appeal are, which can be many and varied, whatever they feel is relevant to their particular case. As you say, in some instances it can be as personal as you know, a pregnancy or a labour, but it's quite varied. It's whatever is relevant to the actual grounds of appeal.
Now, one of the things that you're trying to stop is predatory behaviour by clampers. That is where they're kind of watching like hawks. They're like the cat with the mouse, and they're ready to pounce, you know, a minute over the 10 minutes leeway, and in they go with the clamp.
Well, I suppose the minute over the 10-minute leeway, you know, fundamentally, once the 10-minute has been allowed, the 10-minute grace period has been allowed, then the clamp is valid. When we're talking to predatory tactics, I suppose we're trying to future-proof this code of practice, and we're really setting our stall out and saying to the parking controllers and to the industry that, look, we expect a very high level of professionalism for you. Certainly what we're trying to get at is we're expecting no kind of disingenuous behaviour. We're not, we wouldn't tolerate or want to see a scenario where, you know, a motorist might engage with the clamper to say, oh, I'm going to park here for a moment, is that okay? okay, they indicate yes, and then lo and behold, it's clamped, you know, where the car is clearly parked in contravention of the rules. So, you know, what we don't, we're trying to future-proof as opposed to stop behaviour that is currently happening, and we're just making sure that we're expecting a high standard from the industry, and we think that's the least that motorists can expect, and we think that's a reasonable position for us to require the industry to place itself.
You've got guidance too for the clampers. For example, a motorist becomes unreasonable or aggressive. The idea is what? What does that clamper do?
Well, I mean, I suppose what we would recommend, first of all, is that we would expect that they have quite a high standard of training behind them, and that they know how to deal with that sort of scenario. You can imagine that coming back to your car clamped, especially if you're in a rush or in a high-pressure scenario, that, you know, you might be quite emotive. So we'd expect that the clamping operator to be measured, to try and diffuse the scenario. And obviously, if it reached a level where intervention by the Gardaí was required, that they would make a call. We give similar advices to the motorist. Obviously, if you look at the second section of the Code of Practice, we advise motorists in a similar scenario where they feel that the clamping operator is aggressive, that they should also try and defuse it or step away. Just obviously safety is the primary concern for everybody here. You know, contact the Gardaí, and in the context of the motorist, we would certainly look for them to raise a complaint directly with our office so that we could properly investigate the behaviour, the alleged behaviour of the clamping operator.
Now, sometimes you hear on phone-in shows people giving out about that. They arrive back, the clamp had not been fully placed on the car, and the clamper looks gleefully and says, "Sorry, you're done," or words to that effect, and then locks the clamp. You are recommending if it's not locked, then you get a bit of leeway.
Exactly. We would say that if the clamp hasn't been locked when the motorist returns to the vehicle, that the clamping operator should not proceed any further. That they should just leave the vehicle at that. Similarly, with the relocation, if the vehicle has to be relocated, if only two wheels, or if one or two wheels are only in the air, that they should stop the relocation process.
Now, if, for example, you want to pay the fine, and then it turns out you want to get unlocked, unclamped, but the online or phone payments facilities are not working, then what must the clamper do?
Well, fundamentally, the legislation requires that a parking controller or clamping operator has to afford a motorist at least two means of making payment. So it can be by card, by cash, by a voucher payment system, or another system that might have been approved by yourselves. The reality is that for most parking controllers and clamping operators, it's cash and card. If the card payment facility is not working and the only option that's left is cash, then that's only one payment. So they're not meeting the required standard of having two possible payment mechanisms available to motorists, in which case they cannot clamp. They must desist from clamping.
And you say the clamper may not escort the motorist to an ATM to get the money.
No, absolutely not. We did encounter one submission from a motorist who indicated that, they were driven to an ATM to retrieve money. Now, there was a different version of events from the parking controller. Obviously, we weren't present at the time, but either way, it was a concerning scenario. We don't think that's acceptable at all. If that's why it's so important that the parking controller and clamping operator must be in a position to offer two means of payment without having to leave the location where the vehicle is clamped.
And if, for example, the clamper is using a handheld device that requires an internet connection, and the internet connection is non-viable, it's poor or whatever, the clamper may not say to the motorist, "Will you walk down to the end of the road with me here? There's a better signal down there." Can't do that.
I don't think that's appropriate either, absolutely. I mean, the motorist is entitled to make the payment at the location where their car is clamped, and any request that they have to leave that location, to facilitate the payment process, I think is inappropriate.
Now, the 10-minute grace period, you're saying it should be 11. Why?
Well, we're recommending that they wait 11 minutes because to avoid unnecessary disputes. I mean, you can have he said, she said that it was 9 minutes, 59 seconds versus 10 minutes and 1 second. And while, yes, we have the quite high standard that's required in terms of the photographic evidence, we think it would just be far cleaner and far more straightforward if the clamping operators waited for 11 minutes and it puts the 10 minutes beyond dispute.
Is 1 minute just a bit off because, people will be relying on some sort of timing device, could be their phone, which is supposed to be deadly accurate because it's talking to the provider of the mobile phone service. It could be their watch. What are they supposed to do? Turn on the radio and let's have a discussion
about
the time. It's the
clamping operator's 10 minutes that really we will be looking at. I mean, obviously not everybody's device will be calibrated in the same manner despite what technology might have you think. So fundamentally, we need to see from the evidence provided from the clamping operator that a full 10 minutes, and that it cannot be disputed in any way, shape or form, that a full 10 minutes elapsed from the time they first observed and detected that vehicle to the time that the clamp was affixed onto it.
Okay, so you're saying that if, for example, you have a ticket in the windscreen of your car, that might say 240 or whatever the thing is, but you can't, how do you argue about that? That whose 240 are we talking about?
Well, that should be very apparent from the ticket.
No, but the ticket is only telling you it's 240. It's the time as read out by the machine that's printed the ticket. Who says,
yes, but generally
who
there
says
will
it
be a
really,
date also.
Who says it's really 240? I mean, it could be 242, it could be 238, but the machine is determining the time.
So the photograph that will be taken of that ticket that's saying 240 on the dashboard of the windscreen should tally with that. But in any event, even if there was a slight miscalibration, say, for example, that the photograph that was taken of the spotting time showed that as being 241, well, then we would still expect that the evidence of the 10-minute grace period should show that the clamp was not fixed to the vehicle until at least 251. So we'll be calculating from the photograph time as well as reference to the time.
It's more a fundamental point. Those machines that print out the time, where do they get their time from? Do they get it from the atomic clock in Greenwich, or where do they get the time?
That's a question that I think is best directed to the parking controllers.
Or Dublin City Council in the case of Dublin, because they presumably own
Again,
the,
a parking
own
controller,
the machines.
Dublin City Council is a parking controller.
Yeah. The question of parking by text, the NTA says, while it's up to motorists to ensure they've entered the correct car registration, you also maintain that technology used by parking controllers should be able to recognise invalid year or county formats. What are we talking about there?
So we think there's a fair middle ground to be achieved here. I mean, one of the things that we do see most often in the second stage appeal process are appeals based on motorists having made an error when they're typing in or recording their vehicle registration, when they're trying to pay by an application or pay by text. Some errors, we have come to the conclusion that they are identifiable. Obviously, there's only a certain number of counties in the Irish VRM. Similarly, the standard Irish formatting for a registration only came into effect in 1987, so there's a defined number of years there. so we consider that errors in those two elements of a car registration are actually identifiable to a parking controller, and that reasonable checks can be done to ascertain. Well,
what about if you have two or three cars on your parking app, because there are two or three drivers? Many companies would operate this, and inadvertently you actually click the wrong car. You're paying money, but it's just happens
some of
to be
the apps and the functionality can be, I suppose, improved ever so slightly just to make that somewhat clearer for motorists. I think a lot of the applications will have a tendency to refer to them as Car 1 or Car 2, and sometimes when the motorist is making the booking, then they select Car 1 to park for wherever for whatever period of time, and they're not seeing the registration, I suppose, to trigger that moment in their head where they're like, oh, that's the wrong car. So what we're suggesting is that really where there's a summary before you click to say pay, that the technology is able to just show the motorist that this is the car reg that actually you're going to pay for. Is this what you want to proceed with?
Yeah.
So it's an opportunity for the motorist to just second check themselves to make sure that the car they're about to pay for is the one that's actually the car.
Here's one that I hadn't come across. The parking app council interface isn't great. It doesn't show exactly where you park your car. For example, if you park in a yellow zone on the Keys at 9 a.m. for 10 minutes, then drive to Wicklow for the day, come back at 5 p.m. and park in another yellow zone, say Baggot Street for 2 minutes, the app doesn't know. And as far as the corporate was concerned, you parked in the yellow zone for the day without paying. So they'll clamp you instantly the second time you park in the same zone. Is that true?
I have seen it happen on one occasion, but in those instances, in the one occasion that I've encountered, it was within a very short period of time, literally the car had moved around the corner. In those instances, the information that's provided by the motorist are really, really helpful, because in that case, that person's likely to have made the second payment, so they will be able to demonstrate from their application that they've made two separate payments. They'll be able to show that to the clamping appeals officer at the second stage, and that's where it'll be quite apparent that they had fulfilled their obligations to pay for parking.
Yeah, but
that's where the examination process comes into
its own. But if there's a technological glitch there, it should be sorted, because if your car is clamped or hauled away or something like that.
I've only seen that once. Mm. I don't know so far as to say that it would be a technological glitch. Certainly this code of practice will be an opportunity for all of the parking controllers to look at their technology and see if improvements can be achieved.
The last one is about who's covered by all of this. Suppose you're talking about clamping in a private car park or in the forecourt of a service station or whatever. Are all of them governed by this?
Absolutely. Where clamping activities are undertaken in the state, they're covered by this.
Okay, even apartment blocks and so on. Okay, that's very interesting. That is going out to public consultation. So the clamping regulation manager at National Transport Authority, Patricia Craven, thank you very much.